In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
I'm a bit weird, I guess. I require some kind of evidence when I'm asked to believe something. But how many times can someone hear, "We only have 10 years to do something about climate change," and nothing happen before you stop believing it? I guess for some people, no amount of evidence to the contrary is ever going to shake their faith. Because it's clear by now that fear-mongering that climate change will kill us all not only wasn't happening, but that it's not going to happen. You would think that the first two decades of failed predictions would have killed climate change hysteria, but clever marketing and name changes, first it was global cooling, then global warming, then the catch-all climate change, has managed to keep it alive. And the faith of the faithful. They've managed to keep it going long enough to scare enough people to get enough money to pay off enough politicians to pass more funding to scare more people to get more money to pay off more politicians to scare even more people, and on it went. For the left, it's not just about an issue, it's about an issue to help them win elections to then vote themselves money. And speaking of elections, we have some very disturbing news about what is happening in the Tina Peters case out in Colorado, and a new case we were just alerted to involving the voting machines in Michigan. You will definitely want to stick around for the second half of our show when we talk to Peter Tichton about what his law firm has uncovered. But first up, I would like to welcome Craig Riker. He's the president and co-founder of the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, or CFACT. Craig, it's great to talk to you today.
Hey, Mark, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had hoped to be able to touch base with you while you're down there, but you recently attended COP30, the 30th conference of the parties held in Brazil this year. And for people who don't know, Conference of the Parties, or COP, C-O-P, is the annual global meeting of countries that have signed the UN's Framework Convention on Climate Change. And the COP is a decision, it bills itself anyway, as the decision-making body responsible for implementing those commitments. Or as I like to think of it, COP is the HOA, the Homeowners Association of Climate Change, where a bunch of Karens get together to demand everyone else fix whatever imaginary problems annoy them at that moment. But how much legal authority do COP attendees actually have in their home countries? I mean, their solutions, are they legally binding, or is it all just suggestions and an excuse for airline vacations to exotic locations?
You know, funny you mention it. I think it's actually a little of both. They do have some authority. Now, just a little bit of history. The original convention was signed way back when George H. Bush was in office, the early 90s. Now, of course, I actually, little known fact, was invited into the White House before he went to the Rio Earth Summit, which was in 1992. And I was not by myself, but along with other conservative leaders. And we were going to advise him not to go down and not to sign any sort of accords that were kind of radical, climate being one of them. Anyway, he canceled our meeting at the last moment. I was ready to go to the White House and everything, and he kind of sent a spokesman out and said, "Don't worry about it. Whatever I sign is going to be voluntary and non-binding." And I just like remember all of our eyes rolling, going, "Oh my gosh, if you've been dealing with the UN at all, you know that what starts as non-binding becomes binding." But wanted to do that because it would help him and give him environmental credentials to beat Bill Clinton in the upcoming election. Well, of course, that didn't happen. 3 years later, Bill Clinton's in office. They make it. They have a Berlin mandate that was in 1995. And by the end of the 1990s, they had the Kyoto Protocol, which was binding. Fortunately, George W. Bush did not sign on to that, and it was never ratified. Neither did Obama. And then the Paris Accord came when under Obama's. And that one is supposed to be voluntary and non-binding, but it is binding to a degree. So it's kind of wordsmithing the UN has. As part of that agreement, which, of course, we pulled out under Trump, then Biden got us back in, and now Trump says we're out again. But, of course, if we have a President Newsom down the road, we could be right back in. Until that original treaty that George H. Bush signed, the Global Convention is actually put to the Senate and defeated. They need two-thirds vote. We will continue to have this problem. And the UN is always looking to make their treaties binding. They'll do things like if you don't get your national climate assessment plans brought into them, nationally determined contributions is what they call them. And these are your plans to be net zero by 2050. There may be trade embargoes put against you or, you know, things that, tariffs imposed or things of that sort, things that they're complaining about Trump doing, they would do to nations that don't go along with the program. So they do try to strong arm their views.
Yeah, funny how that is. Well, you mentioned that Trump had pulled out. So COP29 last year's was held a week after Trump won the 2024 election. But this year's was the first COP after Trump took office and officially began taking their money away, as he'd promised. What was it like? I mean, what were your overall impressions? Are they feeling the doom and gloom of that money drying up?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, they're panicked. I would say that I've been to 27 of the 30 conferences going back to the 90s, kind of give away my age there. And I would say this was the most disorganized one yet. I mean, wow. They picked a small venue in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest. I mean, they didn't go to Sao Paulo or to Rio de Janeiro or any place big. They went to this little resort because they wanted the environmental community to feel, now, to experience the rainforest. Well, of course, they couldn't get the housing or everything they need, so they started clear-cutting the rainforest to make more housing and also created a 14-kilometer road through the rainforest.
Yeah, four-lane highway.
Yeah, exactly, which we actually went out to, by the way. And I would say they just ran into all sorts of problems. Take, for example, even the sewage there could not accommodate everybody using the toilets. So they wound up actually outlawing the use of toilet paper halfway through. They wanted people to start using these cloths and putting them in these bins and stuff. It's kind of gross, but that's what they did.
Wow.
They also, long lines and, the accommodations, they wound up charging anywhere you went. You just wound up paying mega prices everywhere. And we paid a lot, and we were kind of in a slummy area. It was dangerous to go out at night. And of course we did, but it still was dangerous. And the lines were long. They could not handle the long lines. You have no air conditioning either in the places that you rent or, fortunately we had little air conditioning in our bedroom at night, but it wasn't the most comfortable confines to have a conference of this sort in. And it was very disorganized. And, of course, you had protesters coming on, the indigenous peoples crashed the gate halfway into the conference. They wanted access and representation.
Did they want access and representation, or did they want more money?
I think they were legit. If you go to these conferences, they divide them up into what they call blue zones and green zones. Now, the blue zone is where the pretty people live. That's the area where when Gavin Newsom comes in, where he spends his time, and that's where the delegates go that represent the nation states. Some NGOs like CFACT are accredited to go in there, so we can get access to it. But then you have a green zone. That's where the regular people go, and that's where they kind of stuck the indigenous people mostly. Not saying none of them got in the blue zone, but the vast majority were in the green zone, and they kind of used them in a patronizing way. They would line them up along the walls. They could sell their wares. If you've ever been to Santa Fe or something like that and saw the Native Americans selling their wares, that's kind of what they did. They made a nice backdrop for the blue zone delegates to wander down there and sip champagne and look at the natives around. It gave them the feel of being in the jungle.
So they were in a jungle or in a zoo, it sounds like. There's the natives over there, and you can go snap some pictures of them. I mean, good Lord, what a disaster it sounds like. But in some ways, what you're describing, the toilet disasters and the mess and the disorganization and the overpaying for everything, that's kind of the world they want for us, I think. Actually, they're in a nutshell. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. We'll continue this with Craig Recker. He's the president of CFACT. That's CFACT.org. If you want to go visit their website, CFACT.org. And welcome back. We're talking today to Craig Recker. He's the president of CFACT. You can follow the great work that they do. Sign up for their newsletter and so much more by heading to CFACT.org. That's CFACT.org. And we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 15-47. You can get to that by heading to ispyradio.com/15-47. And so, Craig, you're back recently from the COP30 conference down there, the Conference of the Parties down in Brazil. And you were describing some of the horror stories of just having to be there. But one of the things that surprised me a little bit was that apparently the Pope spoke to the crowd, or at least it was a presentation that one of the cardinals put on, so it was prepared marks, and he apparently emphasized the moral imperative to act on climate change, referencing the encyclicals of his predecessors and calling for an ecological conversion in both thought and action. And from what I could tell, it looks like an address by the Pope to the COP30 was a first. Was it, or did other popes also address previous COPs, and did you see that, and what were your thoughts?
You know, I was aware of that, and I think he did it by telecast. I'm not sure that he was actually there, but even leading up to the COP, he had a big press conference where there was a block of ice apparently from the South Pole or something that they say is melting.
Yes.
And I always joke, because upon this ice, I will build my church or whatever. But he had a whole thing about the moral imperative of tackling climate change. And you do see at these conferences, I did not go to any of them this particular time, a spiritual component that is always present. Most prominently was 2 years ago in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, when they held one of these, because that happened to be not far from Mount Sinai. And some of the NGOs went up to Mount Sinai, did a big press conference where they were bringing down a new Ten Commandments.
Oh, my gosh. You know, the old ones
about adultery, murder, stealing, all that type. Those are passe. The new ones have to do with lowering your carbon footprint and more relevant things, you know, about not being wasteful and, you know, caring for the earth. Those are the ones.
What about tithing to save the earth, you know, 20% or so?
And I've been at some where they actually do hold hands and they talk to the, you know, Gaia, Mother Earth, and things of that sort. Going back a number of years, I remember they brought in a new Ark of the Covenant put different Ten Commandments in there as well. So there is a religious component without a doubt. That was not as prominent in this particular one. As I say, that the biggest things that they were out for on this was money. It started in Baku, Azerbaijan last year. They had a Baku to Balem roadmap that they were trying to put through. Gutierrez made an impassioned speech before the UN saying, we're not going to reach the goal of keeping the earth within 2 degrees of warming. The solution to this was to give them more money.
Yeah.
And if we give them just enough money, then they'll be able to stab off they want $300 billion a year pouring from the West, which would include the United States, rise at that per year, and then they want to build that to $1.3 trillion by the year 2035. Now, of course, they got a long ways to go with the United States because we're pulling out and not funding them. But again, if you don't ask, you don't get, and we know they're persistent, and they'll probably just outweigh, you know, wait the current administration. And I know they're putting a lot of stock in Gavin Newsom, who is their new hero. Gone is Greta Thunberg, gone is Al Gore. Gavin is the new rock star, him and China.
Yeah, well, I'm not at all surprised that there's a spiritual element to these COPs. And I think in some ways it's fitting the Pope weighed in, because global warming is far, far more of a religion than science. And sometimes, you know, I'm really not sure which has more faith in their beliefs, Christians or global warmists.
That's a good point. They've been obviously proven wrong on so many things, whether it's New York City sinking underwater by the year 2000s, or palm trees showing up in Washington, D.C. in the early 2000s, or the end of snow by 2018, or ice-free Arctic, as Al Gore said, by 2012. All these things are obviously not true, but people, they're not held accountable for them. So they make these predictions and people forget, and they just make them further out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I've lived through 5 decades now of climate change hysterical prophecies, and I guess I'm somewhat immune to them now. But as far as faith and religion is concerned, when it comes to climate change, how big of a deal was it for Bill Gates, the Archbishop of Warmism, to say, "Yeah, climate change isn't going to kill us all after all"?
Well, that was a big one. But if you read his entire letter, he actually does double speak there. He says it's still a serious issue, but it's not the apocalypse. Yeah. Well, that's a baby step going in the right way. The only time Al Gore was relevant was when he was asked by a reporter while he was down there as to what Bill Gates, what that mean. And he said he's just being intimidated by President Trump. He's just being silly. So he apparently they're writing it off as no big deal. You know, it is there. I do want to mention one other huge thing, because we just brought up a bunch of facts that the UN is very concerned in. They put this information integrity declaration signed by a dozen countries right off the bat, saying that the big problem with why they are not getting their agenda through is radio talk shows like yours that we're on right now, but as well as the NGOs like CFAC, you know, Heartland Institute, Competitive Enterprise, these denial organizations. So 12 countries, including Canada, a number of South American countries, and several European countries, started a petition to put $100 million toward working on the algorithms that will squelch people like us, wow, going after who our funders are, and maybe revoking our tax statuses. And Lula, of course, is known as being kind of a strong-arm guy down in Brazil. I guess he's just applying the principles he used against Bolsonaro and his opposition down there, and thinks it ought to go international. But they're targeting our ability to get the truth out to the American people. And I actually think that that's quite concerning moving forward.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's once again a massive attack on free speech. We see that more and more over in the UK, which is very troubling. But, you know, as far as denial is concerned, I don't know how we can be in denial of something that's clearly not happening. It's been 5 decades. I'm waiting for the apocalypse, and I'm still waiting. And it's like, did I miss the bus? Where did it go? Anyway, let's go and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Corey Glucker after this. And welcome back into our final segment now with Craig Riker. He's the president of CFACT. That's the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Visit them at cfact.org. And so, Craig, we've been talking about the Brazil COP30, the conference of the parties there, the Karens of the climate change world here, as they try to nag everybody else into doing what they want. And, you know, going out of that break there, you mentioned this whole denial aspect. And I think if anybody's in denial, it's the global warmists themselves. Because they're denying that whatever it is that they're predicting, it's not happening, and they're in denial about that. It's coming. You know, another 10 years far out there. Just recently, I heard that November 30th is the close of the hurricane season. This is the first year, I think, in 10 or 15 years that we did not have a single hurricane make landfall, and yet we're supposed to have all of these hurricanes, and they get bigger and bigger, all because of climate change. And here we didn't even have one hit landfall this year. So who's in denial?
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, very famously, Al Gore released a movie called An Inconvenient Truth back in 2006, where this was shortly after Hurricane Katrina pasted New Orleans.
Yeah.
And he predicted that we'd get them every year. Well, we went in a 10-year spree of no hurricanes, landfall hurricanes in the United States. Yeah, there were plenty of hurricanes out in the ocean and otherwhere, but we actually went in the biggest pause. So we call that the Gore effect. Whenever Gore makes a prognostication like that, or he has a climate meeting, usually there's a, you know, snowstorm or something that refutes him.
Yeah.
It's almost become kind of comical.
Maybe Al Gore needs to say, well, climate change isn't happening, and let's see what happens.
There you go. So, and you mentioned the spiritual component before, and we got on that a little bit, but I actually do think that part of the reason that they are believing like they're believing is that it's become a matter of faith to these people.
Oh, absolutely.
Show them data, you can show them stuff about hurricanes and wildfires and all the things they fret about, but it's kind of like you get a glazed look from a lot of them. It's kind of like, well, everybody knows it's a problem, and facts don't matter. It's just a statement of faith that this is going on. So it's a difficult thing. I think Trump has opened some eyes by a speech he gave before the UN shortly before this.
Oh yes.
And I think a lot of developing countries understand that the science is a little suspect, but they're being, wooed into going along with this because they receive so much money. They'll be the recipients of a lot of this. So I don't think climate change really has much to do with why they're participating. They look at it as a payday where they can get transfer payments coming from the West, not realizing there's strings attached to it. It's actually kind of diabolical, but they're willing to go along with it, sign whatever, because they're dangling before these countries, these often impoverished countries, just billions of dollars, and saying, you know, if you go with the program, you get that.
Well, that doesn't say much about their religion if they have to pay their believers to believe.
And they get paid well.
Well, you know, the other side of that, too, is the psychological aspect. You know, some of these people are true believers. They're not scientists. They're believers. There's also the psychological aspect of that, because there's nothing that the human psyche hates more than to be proven wrong. And so you'll get cognitive dissonance and a whole bevy of psychological issues where the psyche will simply refuse to believe that they're wrong, no matter how much you confront them with the actual truth and facts and everything else. It's like this lock on their mind where they just can't get past that, because otherwise they would have to say, you know what, I've been fooled. And it's like that old Mark Twain quote, it's easier to fool a man than to convince him he's been fooled. And I think that's what we see so much of with these global warmists.
Oh, there's no question about that. I think that that's exactly one of the big things that we're going against, is that, you know, they don't want to be shown to be stupid.
Yeah.
And we try not to push that in so much. We understand the deception, because, of course, the media has been pumping this for so long. They've learned it in school. You know, it's just been so ingrained in so many yes. people for so long that going against that, you know, trying to move them from that rail to a new rail, it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, no, it's not going to be easy. And a lot of times people just have to learn on their own that confronting them sometimes actually makes them dig in their heels more. I think they just have to see the reality for themselves. You know, the massive snow day or something that Al Gore predicted was never going to be there, and they suddenly connect those two dots. I hope that's what happens for most of these people. But, you know, it has to be, I think, in a large part, an individual situation, that awakening, because so much of it is being pushed on a global scale through the dinosaur media. One of the things, though, that I think we're beginning to see, certainly with Trump pulling tax credits and everything else, increasing regulatory requirements in terms of you can't be buying things so cheaply from China. The tariffs have certainly had an impact on that. In fact, there's a massive solar farm out in eastern Oregon. It was going to generate, it was a 10,000-acre project that was supposed to generate 1.2 megawatts. And that is entering bankruptcy right now because the market's drying up for the tax credits. With the rise of AI, though, I think this may be what pushes things over the edge, because there's no way that green energy was ever going to meet the massive energy requirements needed to power AI. And it is looking to me like that's pretty much the death knell of green energy in terms of wind and solar and hydrogen, which, you know, they were just getting that going, but it was always doomed due to being impractical and unfeasible. Is that where you see this likely to die? Is it the fact at the altar of no more tax credits?
You know, I'd like to say yes. Part of me views what the Greens are doing as almost a feudal system. And as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast about a blue zone and a green zone where the little people live, my fear with AI is that they will get their own independent grid. Discussions are already way on that, where they will be allowed to maybe use nuclear power or coal-fired or even natural gas, more likely, or some other form of energy that actually works, whereas the peasants have to rely on renewable energy. And there is discussion of that.
That would not surprise me at all, because they're doing the same thing with food sources, that it's okay for the elites to have burgers and steaks and everything else, and it's okay for them to travel on private jets. But all you peons know, you're going to have to horse and buggy it.
Oh, exactly. Well, and we see that in the blue zone, as I mentioned to you off the air there. I said the biggest place that people, delegates, went to eat at this UN COP conference was a Bob's Burger. And we thought, maybe they're selling Impossible Burgers or Veg Burgers. No, they weren't, actually. They had one, but that wasn't the popular one. They actually, I think, had a meat shortage at some, because they were gobbling down meat like it's left and right. So these are the very people that are talking about how bad red meat is and how we need to go vegan and how we need to have plant-based or even insect-based diets.
Yeah,
gorging on burgers while they're having a workshop right down the hall from that place.
Saying how evil it all is,
differently. So I see the AI centers potentially going that route, where you would think that that would move away from solar and renewable, and it will for them, because they can't possibly have enough power.
They'll get so much power from nuclear that the solar and wind won't actually generate anything. It'll just be decoration. I could see that certainly happening as well. So, Craig, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Again, that is Craig Rucker, the president of CFACT. Visit them at cfact.org. Craig, thanks again.
Thanks, Mark. Always a pleasure.
Peter Tichtman has been one of those people working to fix so much of what is wrong with America right now, and this week we're going to be talking about two elections cases, the second of which is perhaps the most shocking, because if you thought the left was over the 2020 election and people trying to expose it, boy, you have not heard anything yet. And Peter, if you don't mind, we're just going to dive right in here. There have been some big moves here for Tina Peters and a lot of people that are concerned about election integrity. They're extremely concerned about this case. They think that she was wrongfully imprisoned for just exposing what was going on there. You have some updates on this, so why don't you go ahead and tell our audience about those?
Okay, so the most recent events that have occurred for Tina have to do with, when you're there, you know, you live there all day long, and you go crazy from the locks clashing, snapping closed and so on. You know that sound.
Yes.
A very clear sound. There's certain things there that weaken people and make them, you know, make it harder and harder.
Sure.
She's 70 years old, and just being there is so much harder than for a younger person. But now she's gone through another situation where there was a teacher there who was supposed to be teaching GED to the other inmates, which is a good thing, you know, that they can have that kind of instruction. But this particular teacher, instead of teaching GED, you know, what they need, math, and, reading skills and so on, he was teaching them the Tina Peters story and a left-wing version of it, which is very alarming, because what this teacher is doing is basically getting other inmates to dislike or even hate Tina Peters. So this is worrisome. She complained to him. That didn't do anything. And then there is a grievance process where you're allowed to put in a grievance in the prison. So she made a grievance about this fellow. And what do you think the warden did in return for that?
I would be shocked if he did anything.
Oh, he, no.
I mean anything to help her.
He put her in solitary confinement.
Wow, that is horrible.
She's now in solitary confinement. She has to be, she's restricted. She can't leave there without permission, you know, anything she has to do. I mean, she can leave and make a phone call to talk to her lawyer, which she did. And, you know, look, it doesn't even matter if you're a strong character, strong personality like Tina is. It is horrible.
Yeah, psychologically draining, absolutely. So you hear things like that and you think, this is over-the-top punishment for what she's accused of and what she went to jail for. And it's almost like this validates the fact that clearly she was exposing something super big. Otherwise, they wouldn't be treating her like this. I mean, somebody that's accused of a petty crime, they're not putting in solitary confinement. They're not torturing somebody like this unless there's something big there. I mean, that's what it feels like looking at that from the outside.
Right. And a couple of weeks ago, President Trump pardoned all the people that were involved with any criminality, you know, or any crimes, charged with any crimes for anything to do with anything regarding the 2020 election, where they were looking for, any evidence or whatsoever. And that's exactly what she's accused of. And that's exactly what she did. So she is now pardoned by President Trump. And so we need to get that certified.
So to be clear, isn't that just on the federal level? Because my understanding is she's there based on state crimes.
Right. And we're going to take a different position from that. Okay. Because frankly, this has not been tested in the courts, that one particular issue. People assume that because it's for any violations of against the United States, right? And so we all understand that to be federal. But when the Constitution was written, it was a brand new country. And even up until the time of the federal government's, up until the Civil War and through it, people spoke of the United States not as the country, but as the states.
Yes.
In other words, if let's just say we had a new development someplace in the world, like South America, where 13 of the countries decided they were going to be the United Countries. Okay. Well, then whenever anybody would be referring to them, at least until they became so solidified as one, people would be referring to them as the United Countries. You'd be thinking about the countries that are united.
Right.
And the adverbs that, the pronouns that you would use in these days of pronouns that would be there, right, or they, or a plural. And until after the Civil War, we Americans did not refer to the United States as a singular country. We referred to the United States as the
in the plural, right, yeah.
Of the plural. In fact, if you were to look at the Constitution itself, in Article 3, Section 3, it refers to the United States in that way.
Hmm.
Okay. Article 3, Section 3, treason against the United States shall be consistent only when levying war against them. Not against it.
Right. Yeah.
And
in this case, grammar sort of matters, especially when you're looking into the legal definition of those words and the legal meaning of those words.
Especially
if a federal pardon hinges on the meaning of those words.
Right. And in fact, there is an exception built into the pardons, that pardons except for impeachment.
Hmm.
So if somebody's being impeached, the president can't pardon that.
Hmm.
So the founders knew to make exceptions when they wanted. They didn't say except for state laws.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's an important point. All right. We are up against the clock here. Let's take a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll be back with Peter Tichtin talking about the case of Tina Peters. Stay with us.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense, the I Spy radio show.
And welcome back. We're talking to Peter Tichtin of the Peter Tichtin Law Group, and we are talking about Tina Peters and the potential that she may be transferred out of jail and actually get a pardon. And just to back up a little bit, you mentioned that she was moved into solitary confinement. How long ago was that, and is she still in solitary confinement?
It was yesterday, and she's still in it, and she still is in solitary confinement.
Okay, because 2 weeks ago,
in other words, the prison has a system that they're allowed to make complaints. There's a grievance procedure for the prisoners.
Sure.
And this warden is punishing somebody for using that procedure.
Wow.
Okay, I mean, this is amazing. I mean, this is what they do. This is. Ineptitude at best, cruelty and stupidity at best.
Well, and I remember the left being just apoplectic when somebody looked at the Muslim terrorists down in Gitmo. If you looked at them sideways, they'd freak out. And here's somebody abusing the system designed to protect prisoners here in the United States. She's not an enemy combatant, although I'm sure the left sees her as that because she dared to question the election. This is horrific. I'd asked about the timing on things because that was breaking news to us anyway, that she had been transferred into solitary confinement. But 2 weeks ago, Deputy AG Todd Blanche had requested that she be transferred out of that state prison and into federal prison. Is that something else that you're still exploring?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, because, that's what, look, this happens every day of the week. Maybe not every day of the week. That's an exaggeration, but it happens frequently, where the Justice Department has an interest in a particular prisoner in some state, and they want to make sure that they have control over that prisoner and access to that prisoner. So they will just to make things simpler for themselves, easier, and to deal with things properly, they will get them transferred.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
So as far as the pardon is concerned, you were saying that there does not seem to be a constitutional reason why Trump couldn't pardoned somebody for a state crime. Do you know if that has ever been, has any case like that been tried before?
No. There's no precedent on this.
Hmm. So
it's just a point. Look, everybody in today's world would read the section of the Constitution to understand it to be just for federal offenses. But that's because we're not living in the past.
Right.
If we were living in a time of the founders, it would become much more obvious. I mean, let's just say that we had 13 countries someplace else, let's say in South America or something, 13 different countries got together and decided to unite. And it was the United Countries, right? Well, we would always look at them as the countries which are united. So we would refer to them as them, as opposed to the one country that it forms. So when the Constitution was written, that's the way it was written.
Hmm.
Even after the Civil War, in the 13th Amendment, it's the same thing. Neither slavery, I'm going to leave out the exception part of it, but neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. When they talk of the United States in the Constitution, they're talking of the states, not of the country. And so when it basically says that the president can pardon for offenses against the United States, it's talking about offenses that occurred within the states.
Plural.
Under any law.
Right. Well, as far as trying this in the courts, it sounds like nobody has previously said, hey, there's this state crime, I'm going to pardon them for it. But you also don't have a situation where somebody did try to pardon them and they said, oh, no, that's a state crime, and therefore you can't do that. So it sounds like you've got some real potential here. I hate to drop that, but we've got another big story that we really wanted to talk to you about is these Michigan voting machines that your investigation has found that there were some phone chips on the motherboard. So this is shocking, and this is these were motherboards and voting machines that were being used in the 2020 election. So what can you tell us about this?
And not only are the chips there, but according to our experts, they were accessed. Now, there's a very important name that needs to be brought out in this discussion. Stephanie Lambert. Okay. She is the attorney who is very much behind all of these things. And for some reason, people just don't know her name. But she, believe me, that's the name people need to know. Stephanie Lambert is the attorney who, through her efforts unleashed these and found these. Now, I'm representing Stephanie Lambert because she is like Tina Peters. They have charged her with criminal offenses. They're trying to put her in prison.
Wow.
What, okay. For having the tabulators that had these chips in them examined.
And okay. What is her role? You mentioned she's the attorney. I mean, was she a private investigator looking into this? Is she somebody that works for the state like Tina Peters did? What's her role?
There was a lawsuit.
I see.
And in that lawsuit, she was the attorney that was involved. And in that lawsuit against the county of one of the counties in Michigan, she was basically given leave by the judge to have the tabulators examined.
Well,
and she did.
If the judge gave her essentially the permission to look at them, I don't understand why there's any issue here. So what are they basing this on?
Because Michigan is a far left state. It's taken over by the cabal. Basically, it's gone the way Colorado is. We need to get these back the same way as we got the country back in 2024, thanks to certain heroes that defeated the machines that were controlling the Dominion machines.
Yeah, this is just stunning. Okay, we're up against the clock again. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue this story after this break with Peter Tichtin. And welcome back. In our final segment now, we're talking to Peter Tichtin of the Peter Tichtin Law Group. You can find his website at legalbrains.com, and we'll put that up on today's show page 15-47 on iSpyRadio.com as well. And so during the break there, you mentioned that what happened there in Michigan, that this attorney was examining these machines, found these phone chips on the motherboard, and you said that the judge had given her permission to look, and yet they're still looking at charging her with a crime because you said they changed the law.
Oh, yeah. No. They're not looking to charge her with a crime. The trial was set for March 3rd.
Okay. So that's already in the works. Yes. Okay.
Oh, no. It's been going on for a long time. And,
wow.
Okay. And so, but nobody knows about it, but it's finally starting to get some attention. But the fact of the matter is that they changed the law. There's no requirement in the law anywhere that in order for a county clerk, you know, the official clerk, that's who owns these machines. The clerks bought these machines. The contracts were between Dominion and the clerks, not the Secretary of State. But the Secretary of State, after all this is done, now claims that in order to see these machines or possess them or give them to an expert, they needed her permission.
Wow.
Which is just made up out of the blue.
So to be clear, she gets permission from the judge, she examines these machines, finds the phone chip, and then after she does that, that's when they change the law? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And
so
they charged her for looking at the machines without the permission of the Secretary of State, that she committed a crime.
I don't understand how that works, because if she did it before the law, how can they retroactively charge her with that crime?
Because when you have left-wing judges and left-wing people running the state, that's what happens.
Wow.
You don't have the justice. This isn't America.
No.
Not in Michigan. It's not.
This is just astonishing.
I know. It's amazing, but it's real. You know, and the judge made the, you know, you're not allowed to unduly possess election equipment. Okay? That there is a law about that, and the judge has defined the word unduly to mean without the permission of the Secretary of State or a valid order of a court, and they're questioning whether the first order was sufficient.
Hmm.
Okay, and so that's the way they, in other words, they wanted to word it in such a way that no matter what, they would be able to convict Stephanie Lambert.
Wow, what a message that sends to anybody that dares to look at elections, and that's really the problem, isn't it? Is that you've got a situation where people distrust the elections, distrust the election processes and those in charge and the machines involved in all of it. And then this is what they do. This does absolutely nothing to rebuild trust. In fact, if anything, it proves their point that these elections cannot be trusted.
These machines cannot be trusted. We have an emergency in the United States. The 2026 elections cannot be done with those machines. If they're done with those machines, I guarantee you a tremendous victory will be given to the Democrats because they use these machines.
Right. And now looking at this case, when you've got this kind of authoritativeness going on, these dictators that are making up laws as they go retroactively and jailing people for, you know, like in Tina Peters' case, just for raising a complaint. I mean, God help us if they get back in charge.
Exactly.
Wow. So as far as those chips are concerned, is there any valid reason to have those phone chips mounted on the motherboards other than to allow outside communications to those machines? I mean, for example, I think graphics chips, they have other purposes and other uses than just graphics. I know they're being heavily used in AI and such. I mean, is there something about those phone chips that could be some other kind of processing power that the CPU doesn't have? I mean, is it possible that it's valid?
No, and I say no because we know that the chips were actually accessed. They were used the night of the election of 2020.
Do you know what they were used for?
I understand that it was a foreign country that basically accessed those chips.
Oh, that makes it even worse. It's one thing when Michigan is doing it, quite another when do you happen to know what country
was
doing
that? Oh, no, this is much bigger than Michigan. This, this is foreign interference with our election.
Right. Do you happen to know what country that was coming from?
Well, my understanding, it may not be, you know, but yet my understanding is it's the people that made the chips. I mean, we know that China made these chips.
Wow.
So we have foreign-made machines that are not allowed in the first place because they're foreign-made and they're foreign and able to be foreign accessed.
Is there a way to be able to tell what was when they were in contact with that foreign entity? And we assume China for this point.
Yeah.
Do we know what they were doing? Were they just, oh, well, let's see how the vote totals are going? Were they changing vote totals? Do you know anything at all about what that communication was doing?
We know they changed the vote totals. I mean, you'd have to be a fool to think for a moment that we went to sleep with Donald Trump ahead. We wake up, we see the graphs of the votes. They're all for Biden, all going up, you know, to an extreme where he ends up with 81 million votes. You know, like this guy, he's in his basement. He was able to get six cars to come to a car rally.
Yeah.
And this guy beat Barack Obama.
Yeah. It just fails any logic test, no matter how you look at it. Wow. This is a developing story. We'd love to have you back on to talk more about this in more depth, maybe have you on for the whole show. But unfortunately, we're up against the clock in this show. Peter Tichtenauer, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for putting this out there. It really needs to be told.
Absolutely. It sure does. You know, while listening to Peter Tichten describe what is happening to Tina Peters, and now how in Michigan they are trying to jail an attorney, not some person off the street who broke into the elections office one night and stole a voting machine and cracked it open to find those phone chips, but an officer of the court, someone who was given permission by a judge to open those machines and take a look, and now they're trying to jail her? And while Peter's talking about that, in the back of my mind, I keep hearing and thinking about all of the infighting right now happening among Republicans. Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro and other establishment types attacking Tucker Carlson, and then other Republicans join in on Tucker Carlson's side and attack Levin and Shapiro, and all it's doing is sabotaging Republicans' chances. And meanwhile, we've got this happening. For Pete's sake, people, you're on the same team. It is time to put the differences aside, agree that you're not going to agree on some issues, or even on all issues. It's okay not to agree on everything. But America is at stake right now, and it's time we start acting like it. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.